Welcome to the good old days. I'm Jerome Manigan. I have stories for you from the August 2008 issue of the Good Old Days magazine. We're starting today's program with Fern Prairie Farm. It's written by Della Howell. My first memory is from 1931, when I was 3 years old and living in Fern Prairie, Washington. My five-year-old brother Clyde hit me over the head with a hoe. To this day, I do not grow hair in that spot. In spite of that, my brother grew up to be a very responsible person, and to my knowledge, he has never hit anyone over the head. He is 81 years old now, and he has been a good brother. Our dad was a workaholic. It seemed he worked all the time, yet he managed to spend a lot of time with us. Sometimes in the summer, we went to work with him, traveling in his old lumber truck to his sawmill about 25 miles away. Dad, Mom, and my brothers, Leonard and Clyde, all crammed into the little cab. Leonard rode on the back of the seat, up against the rear window. Mom, Leonard, and I were let off about a half mile from the sawmill at an abandoned shack where a year before a logger and his family had lived. There were berries, vegetables, and fruit trees on the place. Lots of good food was now going to waste, so Dad thought we ought to salvage it. Clyde went on to the sawmill with Dad, where he worked with the men. Mom and I picked lots of berries and vegetables before looking for a place to rest. The abandoned shack was a temptation, and it was unlocked, so we cautiously entered. There were oodles of magazines, but nothing else. We didn't have magazines at our house, and they were such a delight to me. I spent hours looking through them while waiting for Dad to finish his work at the sawmill. We returned every few days during the growing season to harvest more crops. We all had to take on work at a young age. I think I was only 4 when I helped pick up rocks off the land to make a field for corn and potatoes. We all helped hoe vegetables. Dad planted and we hoed. Harvest time was fun, especially when Dad tried to shell peas with the washing machine rollers. Peas flew all over. I can't remember whether he was satisfied with that method or not, but I only remember him doing it that 1 year. My sister was more of a domestic type than I was. She worked in the house most of the time, except when she was ordered to join in with some outside job, like picking wild blackberries in the hills or picking prunes on the farm. We had 12 acres of prunes that we picked and shipped off to the cannery every year. Every year, Dad found time to harvest the hay because he had Clyde's help. At 8 years old, Clyde began operating the farm machinery. At first, he raked hay. Then he advanced to doing both cutting and raking. We all helped haul it into the barn. At 5 years of age, I was riding on the hay wagon and stomping hay down. I began shocking hay as soon as I could pick up a hay fork, and at about 9 years old, I led our horse, who pulled the hay up from the wagon and into the barn with special ropes and pulleys. Many times I had to bring the cows in from about 70 acres of large trees, brush, and pasture. I never knew where they would be. Sometimes I called and they came a-running, and other times they stayed quiet as a mouse. Then I had to go find them. Dad had lots of cattle, and getting enough feed for them was a challenge. To take care of that, he herded some of them into the hills to grazing land called company property, which was about 12 miles from home. At the age of 8, I worked as a whistle punk at Dad's sawmill, relaying messages. Dad helped me get down into the canyon next to the sawmill, around a lot of brush, and up the other side to a huge stump, which became my perch. I stood tall on that stump, watching a man in the canyon who clamped a chain around a log and fastened it to a cable leading up to the sawmill. The man then moved out of the way, and not being able to see the man at the sawmill, he signaled to me on the stump. I relayed his signal to a man who was operating the donkey machine at the sawmill across the canyon. When that man engaged the donkey cable, it pulled the log up to the sawmill. When I was 12, I had to milk 7 cows by hand every night after school. Eventually, I complained to Dad that I didn't have time to do my schoolwork. Dad said, "If you can't get your schoolwork done at school, you might as well quit." I did, and at 16, I went to work at a nearby paper mill. At least once or twice a year, Dad took us on a picnic in the hills. A stream kept our watermelon cold, and the water was deep enough to wade in and play with crawdads if we were brave enough. I wasn't. Fishing for trout with Dad was fun when he managed to take time out. All in all, we were a family that worked together and played together. Yes, those were the good old days. Fern Prairie Farm was written by Della Howell. Let's listen to A Screech in the Night. It's by Lola McClellan. The evening was warm and balmy, with the sun throwing long shadows as it slipped below the horizon. The day was done, and all was as it should be on our small Texas farm. The chores were done, and supper was finished. Mama and Daddy sat on the front porch, holding the 2 smallest kids on their laps, while the rest of us ran and played in the yard. We were having fun teasing toads, chasing fireflies and mosquito hawks, and throwing sticks in the air to watch bats swoop down toward them. It was during the Great Depression, and times were hard, so everyone who was big enough helped with the chores. My older brother and I had the job of bringing in pine chips from the wood pile each evening. Mama used them to start a fire in our big old home comfort range to cook our meals each day. Our breakfast would be hot biscuits, eggs from our hens, butter that Mama had churned, home-cured fried bacon, and thick ribbon cane syrup that Daddy made. He was very good at making syrup, but that's another story. Very few of our necessities were store-bought. Kids in my day didn't argue with their parents, but did as they were told. When Daddy said, "Edgar, you and your sister better get your tub and bring in the pine chips before it gets dark," we didn't quibble. That was our job, so we got our small tub, and carrying it between us, we set off for the wood pile. It was outside the yard, and we hurried so we could get back to our play. We had almost reached the chip pile when the air was suddenly filled with the most horrifying scream we had ever heard. We dropped the tub, and screaming as loudly as our young lungs would permit, we whirled and ran back toward the gate. We just knew that we were going to be leapt upon at any moment. We were back in the yard with the other screaming kids in record time, running to our parents for comfort, like always, but they were laughing. We were stunned. Nothing like this had ever happened before. We could have been killed, and they were laughing. When things settled down, we learned what had happened. It seems that the thing that nearly ate us was a small screech owl, looking for a field mouse for its supper. A Screech in the Night was written by Lola McClellan. Turning now to Dad's Big Surprise. It appears in the August 2008 issue of the Good Old Days magazine, and it was written by Beverly Hill McKinney. "What is Dad taking into the garage?" I asked. "I don't know," said my brother Al. "I'll go see what's up." As Al walked out into the backyard, Dad came out the door and told Al that he could not go in. Couldn't go into the garage? That was unusual. We all wondered what was going on. We lived in the small central California town of Pacific Grove, and the year was 1946. Dad worked as a truck driver for Associated Oil Company in Monterey, California, and Mom was a school teacher. Because Dad drove a stove oil truck, he often brought us small surprises he had been given along this route. We were always excited to see what Dad brought home from work each day. His route ran through the small farming community of Marina, and many times he brought us fresh vegetables, a leg of lamb, or even small chicks. But today was different. When Dad arrived home in his old Ford, he swiftly drove into the garage and began unloading something from the truck. Through the small garage window, it looked to us like two large wooden barrels. But what would Dad be doing with those? Dad instructed my two brothers, Al and Cal, my sister Zoe, and me that we were not to go into the garage as he was working on a surprise for the family. Mom was in on the secret, but we were all kept in suspense. What could Dad be making? Each day when we came home from school, we asked Mom if the surprise was ready. She smiled and said, "You will see it when it's done." It was so hard not to sneak a peek through the garage window, but we knew Dad would find out, and then we would be in real trouble. We all began to speculate. What could Dad be making? Would it be a new doghouse for Blackie? A small table for our dolls and our playhouse? But no, those were big barrels, much too big for a table. How about a coffee table for the house? But he has said the surprise was for us kids. On the following Saturday, Dad was going to Wright's Hardware Store. Dad usually took both of my brothers with him, but this time he told them he wanted to go alone. What could he be up to? Dad came home with a large bundle that contained, among other things, rope. Was he going to make us a new swing? In the weeks that followed, Dad went into the garage every night after work and continued to work on his surprise. We couldn't figure out what he was doing. Summer was approaching, and we were excited about school being over. Would our surprise be for the family cabin in Santa Cruz or for here? When we asked Dad, he said, "It's for here. I think you'll really like it." Finally, one day near the end of school, we came home and noticed that Dad was already there. That was unusual. Then, when we looked out in the backyard, we noticed something behind the big oak tree. Running outside, we saw a large hammock. Dad had strung it from the oak tree to a steel pole he had pounded into the ground. We yelled with delight as all four of us climbed up onto the hammock. Dad had taken the wooden staves from the barrels and drilled holes in them. He then looped rope through the holes in a way that kept the staves flat, making a bed for the hammock. Dad came out of the garage smiling. "What do you think?" "Oh, Daddy, it's great. It's so big we can all swing at once." That summer, after going to the beach, we would come home and climb up into our hammock and swing back and forth. It was so big that all four of us kids plus Dad could fit. Dad was a trooper when it came to his kids. He had as much fun in that hammock as we did. Mom would just shake her head and smile and go back into the house. Of all the surprises Dad brought us during those years, I think our hammock was probably the most memorable. Dad's Big Surprise was written by Beverly Hill McKinney. Let's listen to picking dandelions and blackberries. This is written by Joy Harris Goodall. How poor were we? We were so poor that we had one pair of roller skates between the three of us. I never learned to roller skate because we took turns using one skate at a time. From time to time, I tried to impress on my son the values learned from having little in the way of possessions. My son laughs at what he calls my war stories about life during the Depression, but I think he listens. There were five in our family, mom, dad, big brother, little sister, and me. The folks were building their first new home, and the future seemed bright until the clouds of the Great Depression gathered and it began to rain on our little corner of the world. Besides Dad's loss of a steady income, our parents were burdened with numerous medical bills, and the new house was the first casualty. The most affordable rental properties were not in the best of neighborhoods, so Mom and Dad moved us to the outskirts of Houston, to a community known as South Houston. In the late 1920s and early 1930s, there were fewer than 100,000 people in Houston proper, and we moved to the outskirts. It really meant we were moving to the country. We found a small house on a dirt road that led to the landlord's dairy. Our only neighbor lived in another of the landlord's rental houses about a mile down the road. Our house had two bedrooms, a living room, and a kitchen. The walls were bare wooden planks. Mom cooked using a kerosene stove and oven, and my brother and I did our homework by kerosene lamps. No electricity. A wood stove provided heat in winter. Its flue sending the smoke out through a roof vent. At least we had indoor plumbing that provided a bath and toilet. A large tub over an open fire in the backyard provided hot water for baths and washing clothes. A long porch across the front of the house gave us a perfect place to sit each evening and watch for our dad's car. It was missing one headlight, which made it instantly recognizable from a distance. From the rear of the house, you could see forever. It was flat country, and there were no hills to obscure the view. Oil derricks dotted the landscape, and the flares from the gas they emitted lit our night sky. I entered a poem in a poetry contest for children in which I described the derricks as looking like Christmas trees, and I won $1. The fields around us were full of yellow dandelions and yellow-breasted meadowlarks. In spring, we picked blackberries that grew wild there, and Mom made the best blackberry cobblers in her kerosene oven. My brother and I walked 3 miles to school each day. Little sister, not yet of school age, watched and waved at us from the window. We usually met other children along the way, and by the time we reached school, we had quite an entourage. Our shoes were our main problem. New shoes were out of the question, so when holes appeared in the soles, Dad would very carefully cut a piece of cardboard to fit inside the shoe and cover the hole. This worked fine until the first time it rained. He kept a supply of cardboard on hand for numerous repairs. Although we had little money for extras, Dad and Mom always managed to make Christmas festive for us. The stockings always contained an orange, an apple, and nuts. Brother got a few fireworks, and little sister and I got sparklers. Toys were few, but I received coloring books, and little sister got paper dolls. Dad cut down a tree for us, and we decorated it with popcorn strung on string. One year, we received the latest game. It was called Monopoly, and we stayed up all night playing by the light of our kerosene lamp. Dad worked so hard at whatever work he could get, including contracting for the installation of service stations. He had a great knack for bartering too. A friend of our family owned a bakery, and we were blessed with plenty of bread and sweet rolls that he sent home to us at the end of the day. Although our meals were never fancy, we never went hungry. Mom, who made all our clothes, was an artist in every way. The clothes she made were finely stitched and never looked homemade, and she always added touches of smocking and embroidery. Her artwork extended to painting beautiful pictures in oils and watercolors. A local art dealer and frame shop owner in Houston purchased some of her work, and this added to the family income. Several of her oil paintings of autumn scenes paid one of the doctor bills. These decorated his office, and I often wish I had them today. Naturally, no electricity meant there could be no radio. Our neighbor had a crystal set, and we would go down after school and pick up Little Orphan Annie on it. You could order the Ovaltine mug and the decoder ring with which you could decipher the magic message given on the program each afternoon. Our first television would come 20 years later. We entertained ourselves in other ways with the great human quality known as imagination. Our many cousins came to visit, and we made up plays. Much like Jo and her little sisters in Little Women, we imagined we were actors. College was our favorite play. This consisted of putting on a musical. Imagine our surprise in later years to find that college was not all singing and dancing. After the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt, our financial condition improved, and we were able to move back into town. His campaign song, "Happy Days Are Here Again," certainly fit the mood for our family. We now had electric lights, but Mom still cooked on the kerosene stove, and the wood stove was still our source of heat in winter. Our newest asset was a telephone. It was cheap because we shared a party line. As the economy improved all over the country, the 1930s ended on a happy note. Ignorant of what the 1940s were to bring, we were living what we now call the good old days. I will always miss the dandelions and the blackberries. Picking Dandelions and Blackberries was written by Joy Harris Goodall. Now let's turn to Grandpa versus the Wasp. This is by Lewis A. Cocker. When I was growing up in the early 1960s, my grandfather owned a 60-acre farm near Waterford, Pennsylvania. We kids spent many happy times there, watching the seasons change. One of my favorite memories involved a very pointed lesson learned at one of the smaller outbuildings on the farm. It was the garage where Grandpa stored his old yellow Minneapolis Molin tractor. That garage was like a miniature version of Grandpa's old gray barn. Its weathered wood was tightly nailed to a heavy wood beam frame. It didn't look tightly nailed at first glance. It gave the impression that a slight breeze would demolish the entire structure. But it stood the test of time and refused to budge during the heaviest storms. However, numerous roofing tiles and side slats did budge during bad weather, and the ground around the garage was always littered with them. We didn't often venture into the little building's dark insides. It was not only hung with thick cobwebs, it was also spotted here and there with wasp nests, especially during high summer. The problem started on one of those hot summer days when my sister Becky, brother Stevie, and I found a large active wasp nest in an old metal milk box near the garage. We ran from the buzzing menace as quickly as we could, straight to Grandpa. We knew he would take care of it, and when we told him about it, sure enough, he went right over to the milk box, kicked the lid closed with his foot, and to our surprise, picked up the box. Grandpa, then gingerly made his way to the old wooden rain barrel near the large rusty gas tank outside the garage. The wasps were buzzing angrily inside the metal container. It was the oldest child, and Grandpa turned to me and he walked, saying in his thick Polish accent, "I'll show you what to do with a wasp, sonny boy." "Yeah, sure. I already knew what to do. Stay away from them." He stopped at the rain barrel and held the box over the surface of the brownish green water. The choir wasp had now moved into an exciting third movement as the wave of sound reached a crescendo. Even the farm dog, Butch, picked up on it. He sat up on the top of his doghouse, where he always slept, Snoopy-like, even in the rain, and poked his head around the corner of the garage. He must not have liked what he saw, for he immediately drew it back and disappeared. "Here we go," Grandpa said, immersing the entire container in the rain barrel. An odd wasp or two managed to pop out into the rapidly escaping air bubbles, but for the most part, the water did the trick. Grandpa continued to hold the milk box underwater, and at first I thought it was because he wanted to make sure they were all dead. Then I realized his real motivation. More wasps had gotten out, and they were forming a small cloud of B-52s. They buzzed around his head, and he did not dare let go, lest the entire squadron come shooting out of the water like cruise missiles. When I saw that some of the wasps had escaped, I turned heel and ran for the barn, pulling the heavy wooden door shut behind me and snapping the cast iron latch handle firmly down. Becky and Steve had already moved to a safer location and were watching from the yard. Both of them were decidedly amused. A few minutes later, Grandpa walked away from the rain barrel. The box was still inside, this time with a large rock on it. As I came out of the barn, I noticed he had wasp stings on both arms. "You see, kids," he said with a smile, "that's what you do with a wasp." I gave it some thought. This was the same man who would chew around a warm, worm-infested apple because there were still some good parts left. I decided that I did not always follow his line of thinking, and that in spite of Grandpa's wisdom of years, it was still better to leave wasps alone. The passage of 40-odd years has not changed my opinion. It was a life lesson well learned. Grandpa versus the Wasp was written by Lewis A. Cocker. And with that, we're at the end of today's edition of The Good Old Days. I'm Jerome Manigan, inviting you to join me again next week, same place, same time, for another journey back in time to the good old days. Bye-bye. The Good Old Days was recorded in the studios of Radio Reading Services, WRRS, the voice of information by Kelly.